And just to begin, I know now it's obvious why I said this yesterday, but I wasn't sure I'd have enough time to do much introductory remarks yesterday because we had quite a bit of material I wanted to get through, all the way through the Olivet discourse there. So I think that became self-evident after we started that discussion. But this morning to start, I want to give you a little bit of an idea of kind of what I was hoping to accomplish this week. If you looked at the schedule, my block is entitled Preacher, comma, what about, and then a question mark. But something I discovered very early is a transition that happens is when those around you begin to perceive you not as a guy who preaches, but when for some reason now you become perceived in them as a preacher, people got questions for you. All of a sudden, things change. Before I even started preaching full-time at Eastside, I'd agreed to preach with a little group in a crossroad called Round Hill, Kentucky, about 23 miles north of Bowling Green. And about week number three, as being the preacher up there, hey, preacher, after services, because people want to meet with you. Okay. And then next thing I know, it's me, one of the men, and a couple, and their pregnant teenage daughter in a room. So once you take on that mantle, or once other people decide that's how they perceive you, you start getting questions. And so over the last few years, I've thought about it, and those questions really seem to me to fall into two camps, which really then becomes, as far as the needs of the brethren, and as we think about what do I want to preach on, or what type of things do I want to discuss, they seem to fall out loosely into two broad categories that I would call current and constant. There's some constant needs of things that we know brethren have always needed to hear and will always need to hear that we'll have to revisit from time to time. Let me suggest to you that I would say having that understanding of Matthew 24. That's important. That would have been important if this was 1920, back like the first year J.R. was here. Hey, we only got 50 minutes, folks, all right? But premillennialism would have been an issue, and so an understanding of Matthew 24 would have been something you'd have needed to have and understood that. On Friday, we're going to end talking about denominational baptism. Let me suggest that's a thing that brethren need to understand and have a working knowledge of consistently, and that's also one of those things that people will come up to you when their daughter starts dating somebody or their son starts dating somebody, and all of a sudden they're either reevaluating or want to hear how somebody else feels about denominational baptism. So we're going to talk about some things that are constant, but in the middle I'm going to talk about some things that are current, because the world is not static, right? We live in a world that's dynamic. Things pop up. A little story about abortion the last couple of weeks. Things come across our desks and across the television sets that brethren wonder about and have questions about and want to think about. I'll call current issues. And I want to talk about a couple of those the next 2 days. We're going to talk about women's roles tomorrow, something that is being discussed, and I'm telling you, it's going to be discussed more in the years ahead. And then ultimately, we're going to also talk about what we're talking about today. New heaven and a new earth is kind of where I started. But that's kind of the background. That's kind of the thought of a block of things to think about, a mix of constant and current things we need to talk about. So that being said, the title on Ken's schedule is A New Heaven and a New Earth, because that's what I intended to talk about. That was my plan. Now, what you don't know is that the military definition of plan is a standard from which to deviate. And the primary axiom about a plan is every plan is good, but none survives first contact with the enemy, right? So you can have a plan, but then the world gets a vote, right? So things change, and you have to be able or ready to call audibles. And Ken didn't know this till we were talking about it right now, but I called an audible. But my thinking started around this idea, a new heavens and a new earth. And I don't know what that phrase means to you or what it brings to your mind. But this is a subject that's much discussed, and I'll tell you frankly, it's a lot discussed among even preachers seem, particularly the 30 and under crowd. That's really something that's being talked about a lot now. And if you hadn't thought about this subject, you may read that slide and say, oh, that's a legitimate, interesting Bible topic. And that was my initial reaction. I agree. And if you go back and you'll see that, as I understand it, that phrase, a new heaven, a new earth, when it first appears in the book of Isaiah, at the end of his book in chapters 65 and 66, where the prophet there is discussing, looking forward to a new spiritual order that will exist, and I think will exist in the days of the Messiah. So Isaiah talks about that. So that's a very important spiritual idea and concept. And then over in the New Testament, a couple of the writers pick up on that, and I would suggest would be influenced by the way Isaiah used it. And so you have John and Peter talking about a new heavens and a new earth. And just being a simple son of a farmer from Kentucky, my assumption would be they're going to talk about a new spiritual order because they're using the language of Isaiah in their wording and in discussion of that thing. So I thought, well, this is interesting to me. Let me think about this idea and how that works. But I started digging in what's being propagated out there now on the subject of a new heaven and a new earth. And it didn't take much digging to realize, as I read it, what these folks are really talking about is a renewed heaven and a renewed earth. Not new at all, but this same one being remodeled. And I thought, well, I don't think that's what Isaiah was talking about. And therefore, I don't understand that to be the way John and Peter use that language. So it made it something I wanted to think about a little more. If you haven't been exposed to this or seen this, if you do and will, you'll see phrases like this. Just the idea abbreviated there, NHNE. Sometimes as folks think about their views on this, they'll go ahead and they'll refer to it as renewed eschatology. So that study of the end times, when the earth is going to be renewed, or renewed earth. Or maybe even some of the more scholarly approaches outside our circles use this phrase, new creation theology. And a lot of the popular writers out there are teaching this or identified with this movement. So this is where I began with my thinking and what I intended to address. But the world turned. So in my situation in Bowling Green, Kentucky, I ended up also in the past year dealing with this. And I made reference to this yesterday, the 80-70 doctrine or realized eschatology. And again, I don't know how many of you have experienced this idea or talked about, thought about, read about this idea. But this kind of landed in our lap in Bowling Green at Eastside. And so as we dealt with studying with folks and about the subject to be able to deal with folks, and then quite frankly trying to think about inoculating our young folks against the influence of this doctrine, I started thinking, you know, to deal with this, I can take a step back and deal with both of these things the same way, and that's what we're going to do here. But let me just, for purposes of our introduction, if you're not familiar with this idea, a preacher named Max King really popularized this theory of realized eschatology among churches of Christ. And my understanding is it began in a preacher meeting like this in Ohio in the early 1970s, is my understanding. But his book, entitled The Spirit of Prophecy, among our brethren, that seems to be the flashpoint, the jumping off place for this idea. And if you don't know anything else about this doctrine, this is a... when Max King held a debate, this is what he affirmed as his position in it. This is one of the prospects of the debate, and this is what he affirmed. The Holy Scriptures teach that the second coming of Christ, including the establishment of the eternal kingdom, the day of judgment, the end of the world, and the resurrection of the dead occurred in the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And Brother King and those who believe in this 80-70 doctrine would affirm those things. So just read that list again and think about that. But you'll notice nestled right in the middle of that list is the idea that the end of the world happened in 70 AD. Now your initial response to that is, but wait, I'm right here. So what you then realize is they have a spiritualized idea of what that meant. So then point 1B to that is, so then they believe and teach and advocate that this physical universe will continue into perpetuity. So between the idea of the renewed heavens and earth and the ideas of AD 70, I decided to take a step back and say, how can I start laying the groundwork to make sure my thinking is right about both these ideas and maybe help people with the kind of a building block approach to be prepared to deal with both these ideas. And the way I thought to do that was I'm just going to ask the question, what will happen to the present heaven and earth at the end of time? And my conclusion, kind of a spoiler alert, is in the title of this morning's lecture, Heaven and Earth Will Pass Away. And the scripture there is one you're familiar with, 2 Peter 3:10 through 13. Probably the most important scripture in my mind as far as confirming the ideas and thoughts that I came up with. But we're not going to start there, but I promise you that is where we will end up. But I want to think about this idea. And here's what I want you to notice, is that the Bible teaches an end to this physical universe indirectly. And when I say indirectly, what I'm saying is that it's a point that is made even when that's not the main point. And I want you to notice that it begins pretty early in the book, way back in Genesis chapter 8, you can look at this piece of evidence. And in context here, Genesis 8, 22, you recognize that this is God's covenant with Noah after the flood. And what God says there is, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. I just want to draw your attention to the phrase that that verse begins with, while the earth remains. And I would just suggest that even the most natural reading in English is we're talking about a period of time that's indefinite, but it's while something is going on, and that would just be the takeaway for that, just reading it in English. And if you consider some of the other translations of this verse, I think you'll see that that is pretty much an agreed upon understanding of that. The NIV says, as long as the earth endures, which my thought would be, well, that means it's not always going to endure. Another version, the Young's Literal says, during all the days of the earth. Well, in English, that means there's a duration of time we're talking about here, but definitely not something that would be considered permanent or that would not come to an end. Or even the NET says it this way, while the earth continues to exist, which my response would be, there must be a time when the earth will not continue to exist. Or you wouldn't use that word while. Again, just in a basic English understanding of this verse that is demonstrated by the various translations. But beyond that, I found it interesting as you think about the word remains, which again, all the things we've already said, just reading the English word, I think that's your natural thought. But if you dig a little bit, that word remains is actually a derivative of the Hebrew word yom. Now, even those of us that have about a one-word Hebrew vocabulary, this may be it. So, crowd participation, what does the Hebrew word yom mean?
Day.
Yeah, but you know, it's a word that has a lot of different shades of meaning, a lot of variation on it. This derivation of it, as I understand it, actually is day used this way, day as opposed to night. What that means is, in a technical sense, a day you would say, well, that's a 24-hour period, right? Everybody good with that? But it's pretty much divided between day and night, right? So we recognize the difference between when it's light outside and when it's dark outside. And we use the word day, even in English, sometimes to mean that period of that 24 hours where it's light outside, right? Everybody with me on that one? That's the shade of meaning that this word conveys in this usage here. Day as opposed to night. And you see that in some of the examples that you can find in a lexicon. It's used this way. The day is still high, not near its end. Implied in that is the day, eventually it'll be low and eventually it will end, right? Another phrase would be, until the declining of the day. When used that way, there's the expectation that the day will what? Decline. Or the last one, the day hath sunk down, becoming evening. And all these show that transition from daytime toward dusk to dark. But all that is a day, right? But this is the nuanced meaning of that word, that derivation of the word yom as it appears in this verse. So what I suggest to you, that the point, I think, from Genesis 8:22 is this earth will end just as surely as day fades into night. And that seems to be the weight of the language used there in Genesis 8:22. But you keep coming through the Bible, and we'll find out that the Bible teaches the into the physical universe indirectly, even in the New Testament. And here I think you start to see the importance of context in some of the passages that we're going to talk about. You're familiar with what's going on in this section of 2 Corinthians chapter 4, where Paul is doing a contrast. And so often you'll see contrast when we talk about this idea of the end of the heavens and the earth. Paul here in 2 Corinthians 4 is contrasting our outer self that is wasting away with that inner self that's being renewed day by day. Paul here in 2 Corinthians 4 is contrasting light, momentary affliction with the eternal weight of glory. So there, clearly in context, there's this contrast between something that's not going to last and something that is. And so then Paul concludes in verse 18 by saying, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. And as Paul's contrasting that, what he's talking about, the things that are seen are those things that are part of the material universe. Those things that you can walk out and see. Even our physical bodies are part of the created material universe. Here, Paul's contrasting that with things that are eternal. And then the key word, I think, in this verse, as you try to consider what Paul's point is, he says, look, those things that are seen, Paul says they're transient. Well, sitting right now, you have a working definition of how the word transient hits you, don't you? You know what is meant by that word and the ideas that it convey. Again, we can go and look at some of the other ways that verse is translated. The NIV tells us that the things that are seen are temporary. The New Literal will tell you they will soon be gone, which again matches with our idea and understanding of the word transient. And the Amplified describes those things that are seen, the part of this physical creation, as just brief and fleeting. Again, all are ideas that the word transient easily demonstrates for us. It's also, I think, telling here to look at a definition. You go back to Thayer and say, well, what does this word mean? The idea is it's simply something that endures only for a while. While, just like we saw back in Genesis 8 and verse 22. So we understand what this word means. And let me suggest to you, as Paul is drawing this contrast, what he's saying is these things that are seen, they're temporary, they will soon be gone, they're just brief and fleeting, and they endure only for a while. So from Genesis chapter 8, the back of the book, up into 2 Corinthians there in the New Testament, we see a consistent usage of the idea, I think. And then even the Hebrew writer gets involved in this, making this point indirectly. Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 through 12. And you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. See that contrast between the eternal? And in order to have a contrast with something that's eternal, you need something that's not eternal. Or you don't have a contrast there. They will perish, but you remain. They will wear out like a garment, like a robe. You will roll them up like a garment. They will be changed. But you are the same, and your years will have no end. And it's clear to see the important word here is perish. The Hebrew writer says, speaking of the earth and the heavens, God, they're the work of your hands, but they will perish. And I know each of us has a working definition and understanding of what the word perish means to us. Typically, literally, it's used in the idea of an animate object ceasing to be alive, to die, right? When it's used as something inanimate, like the creation like this, it has a more of a metaphoric idea, but the word simply means or implies permanent or absolute destruction. That's what the weight of the word, and that doesn't surprise you, because if you think of when someone perishes, that's a permanent situation, right? And as I said, when you use it for something, well, the term wear out is also here. So you think about the heavens and the earth, the writer here says they will wear out. That word carries with it this idea. It's used, the usage, I pulled the usage here because I thought it was, I make old or I declare obsolete. So the heavens and the earth will become obsolete at some point. What happens with obsolete things? They're thrown away, discarded. And that brings us to kind of the third thing that's brought here. But I want you to think about these ideas and the way the language. But you're all good, astute Bible students, and you were reading ahead, and you were thinking, oh, but wait, Bob, down there it says, they will be changed. And I said, you're right. And I also tell you that sometimes when we use the word changed, it means transformed, doesn't it? Sometimes we say that's going to change, and what we mean by that, the delta, it's going to transform. I get that. But you know what? It doesn't mean that when you're talking about changing clothes. In English, it doesn't mean that, and I don't think it does here either, and that's the way that is embedded. When he talks about they will be changed, he says they will wear out like a garment, like a robe, you will roll them up, like a garment they will be changed, and then God, you are the same. When you change clothes, you don't transform the same clothes you just had on, do you? And I think the idea here, even in that language it talks about it, is this, that they're going to perish, they're going to wear out, and they'll be changed just like you change a worn out garment. A worn out garment is removed, rolled up, and discarded when you change into a new one. That seems to be the weight of the language here from the Hebrew writer. When you change clothes, they're removed and replaced. But I want you to notice this. So that was Genesis to Hebrews, different writers indirectly making that point because they had other arguments. But let me suggest to you that Jesus teaches an end to this physical universe indirectly. And these are passages you're familiar with. But in Matthew chapter 5 in verse 18, Jesus says this, "For truly I say to you, until heavens and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished." And Jesus in here uses this phrase in order to set up his main point. Until is a word that conveys with it duration. But he says, until the heaven and earth pass away. So here Jesus says the heavens and earth, or implies the heavens and the earth, will pass away. That language there, that phrase, when used metaphorically again of something inanimate, means to pass away or perish, Thayer tells us. And that's what Jesus says is going to happen to the ends of the earth, or to the heaven and the earth. And again, see that it's the proposition here is one of contrast. What Jesus is really affirming is the surety of His words, the surety that He will fulfill the law and all that was written of Him. This is how certain it is. Until heaven and earth pass away, you can be sure that not one part of the law will go without being fulfilled. But it also suggests, as you think about this word, come to an end, or a viable translation of this word is disappear. So Jesus could be saying until heaven and earth disappear. And in fact, the NIV translates it that way. If you're reading the NIV and you get to Matthew 5:8, "For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear." Jesus says that, implying, I think, that they will. But let me also suggest that Jesus teaches an end to this physical universe directly. So he teaches it indirectly, but I think he also teaches it directly in a verse we shared a discussion about yesterday in Matthew 24. Do you remember there, by the time you get to verse 35, it's as the way we outlined it yesterday, Jesus is affirming to his apostles, having brought them down to the point of assuring them that God is going to come in judgment against Jerusalem, and kind of circles around to say, fellas, this is certain. This is going to happen. And what we talked about yesterday, it may well be that he thought among his followers there might be that hope, that little bit of maybe Jewish hope that, yeah, but you know, we're God's chosen people. This is His holy city. Maybe if we straighten up, maybe if we repent, maybe He'll relent on this idea. And I think Jesus is trying to convey that no, God's already decreed judgment against and the destruction of Jerusalem. And this is kind of His final guarantee that no, this is going to happen, fellas. He says, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Again, I think Jesus is using that idea to affirm the certainty of the prophecy, the certainty of God's decreed judgment on Jerusalem. And you can see, again, other versions that translate it this way have Jesus saying, heaven and earth will disappear, but my words will not pass away. So here we still have the idea of contrast that's going on. Jesus uses this language to contrast the eternal nature of the words of the Creator against the temporal nature of his creation. And that seems to be in play both these places that Jesus says that. But then way over toward the back of your Bible, and again, I think you see this consistent theme cover to cover, John revealed the destruction of this physical universe in his apocalyptic vision. And this is a passage we're all familiar with back in Revelation 21:1. And whatever else you think about the vision in Revelation 21 and following there, here's how John begins it and sets it up. He says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." We've already talked about what that phrase means, had passed away. John's saying, "I saw the new because the first had passed away." I would suggest to you, it's just like the sea. John says, it was no more. That first had passed away, had disappeared even, would be an acceptable translation of that word. And that's what John had to say about it. So we've been from Genesis chapter 8 to Revelation chapter 21. And I would suggest to you that the Scripture consistently, indirectly, then directly, then revealed as truth, the notion that this present material creation will pass away, will disappear, will cease to be, from Revelation back to Genesis. And then the last one we're going to look at, so John revealed it. Multiple writers talked about it indirectly. Jesus talked about it indirectly and directly. And I would suggest to you that Peter teaches an end to this physical universe emphatically. And so now I'd ask you to go ahead and turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. And we'll look at that here in the last few minutes of our discussion. So 2 Peter chapter 3 in verse 10. It's a passage again we're familiar with. Peter there writing says, "But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed." And I think you read that, you come away immediately with an understanding of what Peter is talking about. As you read that, you see his subject is the heavenly bodies, or the heavens, the heavenly bodies. That would include earth and the other all those things that are on that picture in your sixth grade science class wall. That thing, that's what he's talking about, the creation. And you'll notice language we've seen already. He says they will pass away. And he uses other language. It's similar to that. But I think you read that, you see that's how what he says about the heavens and the heavenly bodies. But you may have already also noticed, and here's where some a little more discussion needs to happen, is the way, this is the ESV up here. Verse 10 ends with this word, "And the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed." So you read that. And it may be that you're like me, well, most of you are not old enough to remember this, but some of you are. You may hear that and you say, "Well, that doesn't sound right to me." And I say, I think I know why that doesn't sound right to you, because you probably grew up hearing in the King James. And if it's so, then you expected that verse to end this way, that the earth and the works that are on it will be burned up. And you remember hearing that ending. Let me just assure you that's not just some King James-ism. And in fact, there are other, not only the King James, but the New King James, the ASV, and the subsequent New American Standard variants, and other versions translate it that way. Will be burned up or burned up. So that is a translation. But then you're looking at it and you say, well, but the ESV says exposed. And what we have here, folks, is a textual variation. So what we mean there is that there's some discrepancy or some difficulty in resolving what the translation ought to be. And in this case, it's because there's manuscript evidence for actually two distinctly different Greek words. And the thing about that is, if you read and you study on 2 Peter 3:10, it seems to be pretty commonly agreed upon among commentators and scholars. In fact, the quote I have here is talking about this very issue, where there is manuscript evidence for two different Greek words. It's described as one of the most difficult textual variations in the New Testament. And no matter what they say next, almost every scholar says something like that. This is one of the most difficult ones to wrestle with. But I want you to understand this. When they say that, their point is universally this. It's difficult because the evidence is equally divided. It's not difficult because it significantly challenges or changes the meaning of the passage. And that's a very important thing to understand. So what I would tell you is I believe or understand this to be a textual variation that really ends up being a distinction that makes no difference in our understanding of the passage. Because when we look at this a little deeper, you're going to see, although they're different, the overall teaching of the passage isn't impacted. So I believe this is a distinction that makes no difference, but some want it to. Some really want it to. And let's think about that for a minute. This is a quote from Chris Reeves, who presented on this idea at the Truth Lectures last year. He was down there. And here's what he says about it. And some of you will recognize everything we're going to talk about is, oh, that's the old Jehovah's Witnesses position. And that's why. But Chris Reeves says this: the Jehovah's Witnesses and some contemporary Bible scholars argue that the English translation will be found, discovered, or laid bare in verse 10 is better than burned up. They say the ancient manuscript evidence is better for exposed, which is the translation of the ESV we've been looking at, is better for that than it is for burned up, as the ones that some of the older versions have, and which again is a different Greek word. So the point is they've decided, well, this evidence is better. Well, I tell you why the Jehovah's Witnesses have decided that, because in their version of the Bible, their sacred text is called the New World Translation, and it's been that way for years before otherwise widely translated that way, I believe. And according to one of their scholars, it says it's in order to support the teaching that most of the saved at some future time will live on a renovated earth. So that's always been part of the Jehovah's Witness doctrine, and their own translation has seized upon that particular textual evidence because it supports that teaching. But Chris makes an observation here that not only the Jehovah's Witnesses, but some contemporary Bible scholars argue. And let me suggest to you, when he uses that phrase, some contemporary Bible scholars, that will include the advocates for the new heaven, new earth that we talked about. That would include the new creation eschatology or NCE advocates that we're talking about would argue for this as well. That exposed or disclosed or laid bare is the better translation. But let me suggest to you this, that if that is the case and you think it's one of those three words, any of those translations, exposed or laid bare, begs a question. Exposed for what purpose? Laid bare to what? There's a question that is begged, I think, by that translation. And I think Chris picks up on that. Because it begs a question, well, these folks are glad to provide an answer for that. And let me suggest to you that any answer is an assumption, because we're not told here. But here's what Chris says. Thus, according to them, that would be the Jehovah's Witnesses or these scholars, the earth and its works will be discovered or laid bare for renovation and restoration. That's how they answer that question. And again, I say that is an assumption. And it's important to think about this, because by taking this, you totally change the statement. You make it opposite statement. It's not a minor variation to go from being will burned up to ultimately the impact of saying laid bare for restoration is you're saying will not be burned up. So that's what's important, because it now makes it a completely opposite statement, if that is the way it should be understood. But I want to think about this for a minute. Maybe exposed or disclosed or laid bare is the best reading. Because as I admit, the scholars are split on this, and there is almost equal weight of textual evidence to go either way. And it may well be that that is the best reading. So then how would we come up with an idea of what to do with that? Maybe we could go to the immediate context and get an idea of what the overall teaching of the passage is. So let's consider that. Maybe exposed is the best reading. Well, let's go back and see what we can learn from context. We go back and begin in verse 10, and I want to read everything around this. In fact, listen, pretend you can't see this word at all. Or could pretend we've looked at this word and go, I can't figure out what this word means. Can context help us out a little bit? What's going on? What's Peter really trying to convey to us here in this passage? And let's just read along. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and the heavens and the earth will pass away with a roar. And the heavenly bodies will be burned up and be dissolved. And the earth and the works on them will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought we to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of the Lord, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to His promise, we are waiting for new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells. I just want you, I use highlights there for the purpose of, just pretend this is a visual exercise. And I want you to see the preponderance of language that I think you readily understand. And let me suggest to you that this is Bob's view of it. If I had no idea what this word meant, I'd get an image in my mind of the idea of passing away with a roar. I know what melt means. I know what dissolve means. And I love this. It's like, it's dissolved. Well, not only is it dissolved, it's set on fire and dissolved. You know, and it's going to melt. Why is it going to melt? But it's because it's going to be burned. And so all those phrases are there irrespective of what conclusion you come away with exposed. So you look at that and you go, okay, that seems to be, in my mind, that seems to be what the immediate context is teaching. And so if I look at that, and I still got to answer that assumption, exposed to what? Laid bare for what? And let me suggest to you that looking at that, my guess would be it's exposed to God's judgment by fire. I think it begs a question. That seems to be the textual and contextual answer to that question. So, brethren, that's why I would suggest this is a distinction that really makes no difference. Because think about it this way. There's no real difference between being exposed to fiery judgment and being burned up. Is there any substantive difference between those two ideas? And I would suggest that there's not. But just to make sure, let's broaden the aperture out just a little bit more. What else can we find in context? And just move up to verse 7. Just make sure we're headed in the right direction by the time we even get to verse 10 and look at this. In verse 7, Peter says this, "But by the same word, the heavens and the earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly." It's just a couple phrases here that jump off the page at us. Peter says the heavens and the earth that now exist, so this present material creation, are being stored up. Think about this. When something is stored up, is that a permanent situation? No, you talk about short-term storage or long-term storage. But why do you store things? Because you think you've got a use for them later. They're going to be used, serve a purpose later. You store them until something, right? Well, what are these being stored up for? Peter says fire. And then he also gives us that word, until. So they're stored up for something. And Peter says, it's for fire. Until the day of judgment and destruction that he talks about. So again, I would suggest to you that even back in verse 7, in the section as it begins, that context seems to bear itself out. Go back to verse 10 though. Because here is what I want us to think about. The point here is, if anyone tries to make too big a deal about that textual variation, brethren, I think they're just making too big a deal. And that's what I want you to take away from this. Because even if the word there is exposed, or is the Greek word that's translated exposed or laid bare. And again, you'll see it in various translations. The ESV, the CSB says disclosed, or the NIV says laid bare. Even if that is the best, we have the best textual evidence for that, The context of the passage is so much so that it begins to influence even definitions that scholars provide for that word. Because if I go to Thayer to find out what that word translated exposed means, he defines it this way: shall be found. But the context of 2 Peter 3:10 is so powerful that even the scholar says, shall be found, namely for destruction. That's what it would be found for. It would be unable to hide themselves from the doom decreed them by God, as in 2 Peter 3:10. So even a scholar looks at that context and says, this word in this context means they'll be found, but clearly for that judgment of fire. In fact, some translations look at the translation teams, look at the context and make a very similar thing. If you're reading the New Living, it says they'll be found to deserve judgment. And the judgment, as again, we've already seen described as that judgment of fire. But very interesting to me to see as this kind of tension around this passage plays out, is there's an alternate translation that's starting to see more, because it may be now that the best ending for verse 10 would be, will not be found. And you look at it, where'd that come from? Well, I'll just say this about that. There's already the Berean Literal Bible and the Literal Standard Version have come around to using this translation, will not be found. But what probably is most significant, in my mind anyway, is that NA 28. Everybody familiar with what that is? That's the Nestle Aland version 28. That pretty much is the Greek text upon which all of the more modern Greek New Testaments are translated upon that. That's kind of the standard by which translations, more modern New Testament translations are done. And in the 28th revision of that, this is how they've come away with, will not be found. So if translation teams continue to rely on the Nestle Aland text for their translations, that is now the scholarly agreed upon best reading of 2 Peter 3:10. So I want you to think about this, because you look at that, and we've done all this talking about this thing, that they'll be found for judgment, and so will not be found seems a little bit jarring when you think about why would that be the case? So that's a legitimate question. If your question in your mind is, well, why not? I think that's a pretty good question. But you know why they will not be found? Because heaven and earth will pass away. They will be burned up, they will be dissolved, they will be set on fire, and they will melt as they burn. And when that happens, you know what? They won't be found. Like John said, they will disappear. The heavens and the earth will be no more. So this is what 2 Peter 3:10, I think, teaches. And I think it's so important to keep it in its context. But then I'm going to exhale now, because I've been talking fast for 35 minutes. But you might say, okay, well, why does this matter? And I'm going to tell you why this matters, staying right here in context, and why I think this is so important. Because Peter had a point he was making based upon our understanding of this passage. Peter had a point he was making to those of the dispersion that he was writing that's based upon them understanding that this present created world would pass away, would someday be burned up. And Peter phrases it like this, right in the middle of what we were reading. He says, since all these things are thus to be dissolved, so what I'm about to say next is predicated on you understanding that's what's going to happen. All this physical creation is going to be dissolved, melted, burned up. And since that's the case, brethren, what sort of people ought we to be? Peter wanted that fact understood so that he could leverage it to compel us to something. What sort of people ought we to be? Peter said, brethren, knowing that this world is going to burn up, that all that these things below are transient, we got to live lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of the Lord. Peter had a purpose for stating that truth, to then try to make an application for us. So brethren, I simply present to you my understanding, my conclusion I've come to now from Genesis to Revelation, that the Bible presents a consistent answer from front cover to the back cover to our question. I believe the Bible to teach that the present heaven and earth will pass away. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Good stuff, brother.